Hello again, everybody, and welcome to this episode of Scope of Practice, a podcast from the Connecticut Certification Board designed to address thought-provoking issues and spur conversation on the topics discussed. The CCB is a 501c3 nonprofit organization whose mission is to cultivate and to maintain the highest standards of professional practice within the recovery field. Thank you for joining us. It was sometime back in the late 1990s as I was sitting in Julius Newman's community organizing class at UConn School of Social Work, where we watched a documentary from Connecticut Public Television. If my memory serves me correctly, it was titled The Two Connecticuts. On one hand was the Connecticut that people saw and knew of, the affluent suburbs with the green lawns, shade trees, the in-ground pools. Clearly an overly idyllic view, but perfect for the contrast filmmakers were looking to create. On the other hand were the urban environments, most notably Hartford, New Haven, and Bridgeport, which were solidly holding place among the country's 10 poorest cities at the time. The structural, physical, and moral decay of such places were mentioned throughout the film. Both sides were exaggerated for effect, and most of my classmates were absolutely shocked. Shock value notwithstanding, there were some accuracies about the demise of the American city, tracing directly to the development of the interstate highway system and development in the post-World War II United States of the Eisenhower Formation. When it was created, but at the time we didn't have language for, were the stark differences in the social determinants of health within this small state. Our guests today are part of a project that succeeds not only naming the social determinants of health, but hearing about them from people in our cities, whether large or small, as they've reported them, as well as from academics who have expertise on the topic. Please welcome Robert Lawler, Drug Intelligence Officer, and Anna Gasinski, Public Health Analyst, Overdose Response Strategy. Welcome to the program, guys.
Thank you.
Appreciate you having us.
Just to start out, can you talk a little bit about the genesis of the Silence of the Streets documentary? Kind of what ignited the project, and how long was the process from the very beginning to when you released the film?
The genesis of the project really began in probably late spring of 2022. We were in conversations with the U.S. Attorney's Office, and some of the things we were discussing is the way they're interacting with schools and trying to bring drug education to schools and interact with really high school kids about some of the problems. I mean, one of the things that got brought up is the need for a new film in the vein of Chasing the Dragon, but something more up to date and something a little more realistic for some other areas of the country. So that really got Anna and I thinking about what could we do and how can we maybe do something in this area. And one of the things that had struck me is I had participated in being on a panel after a play called Matthew Rising, which was done by Sharif Salem Hanna, talking about really dark web drug sales and other impact on the inner cities. And a lot of the things that were brought up during that play really resonated with me as a former New Haven police officer and seeing some of the issues that inner city minorities deal with, that people in Simsbury and Greenwich and some of these other affluent towns in Connecticut don't really deal with. And I then thought about, okay, well, can we get Sharif involved and maybe create a documentary that really talked about these issues, talked about the social determinants of health, and talked about how the struggles of inner city minorities, specifically here in Connecticut, given that you brought it up in the opening about there really are two Connecticuts. And I think if you don't live in Connecticut and you live outside of Connecticut, you have this, the Greenwich, yuppie, sailing, preppy type view of Connecticut. And while there is some of that here in Connecticut, there is also the other side of the coin, and we have some really poor, impoverished cities and some issues in those cities that really need to be addressed. And a lot of those issues are root causes of addiction and will lead to addiction. So we began this journey of talking to Sharif about these issues, what a film would look like. We weren't totally on like, oh, we need to do a documentary. That was one of the ideas we had, and we settled on the documentary. And I think from start to finish, once we enlisted Sharif and did the go ahead, we really started. It was really about a full year. We started in December of 2022, and the film was completed basically in November, December of 2023. So it was about a full year.
That's a really pretty quick process overall when I talk to other individuals like Hope Payson and other folks that have made films for it to actually take place and come to fruition. You know, the trailer for the film, which is available on YouTube, it really does a nice job spelling out the purpose and kind of why the film was made. But can you explain it for our listeners?
So the Silence on the Street trailer, given that this is really filmed and made to serve as a educational tool, it really just trying to shed a light on the cycle of addiction, especially from the perspective of our city minorities and Native Americans. When we were doing the planning process of this, we kind of bounced around a lot of different ideas and really wanted to focus on some personal stories, narratives, but as well as using experts from the field, because as much as we hear about persons that are in recovery and have found their pathway, we felt like we still wanted to have the educational piece of it, and having experts and having that piece be really intentional in the film, especially it is being shown to parents and young people. So that's really where those two kind of came together. And so the documentary really explores some really complex factors that influence the root of addiction. As Bobby said, we really tried to focus on stigma, language, and we wanted to focus on poverty, inner city issues, mental health issues, and then those social determinants of health as well. So we have interviews from a lot of physicians, treatment providers, persons that are in recovery, but also now give back, so peer support specialists. And so we also have our U.S. attorney in Connecticut, the current one, being interviewed, the DEA. So we have a lot of different points of view that really bring this documentary to life from different angles.
I think the different points of view really come together nicely. I like the academic side. I like hearing that. It piques my interest. I like to hear what the U.S. attorney had to say, but I also really took a lot out from the people living in our cities, what they were saying. This is how they found their recovery. And here's the barriers, and some of those barriers, as they're explaining them, may be too great for individuals that they know to overcome. Having an affinity for New London and seeing Ocean Beach in the background where I spent so much of my childhood, it made it hit home for me, and it brought forward things that I had seen, and at the time seeing them did not understand the impact of them as a kid. You just see these things. It's just part of your environment. You don't think much about it.
I was just going to add too, I think from our positions where we sit on being subject matter experts in the field, Bobby has prior law enforcement experience. I have a background in public health. I think what the film did a really good job was to humanize the data that we look at all the time. We hear that we lost over 100,000 people. We hear the statistics that we're losing more people to overdose than we are to homicides, suicides, and car accidents, right? And to your point, Jeff, I think that that's something that those personal stories really were able to bring to life, is we hear these numbers, but here's the people that are actually a part of it.
And I think that people often don't see how law enforcement and public health work together for to better the lives of others. I was very lucky. I got a chance to spend some time with the chief from Massachusetts who started PERI. Got to talk to him, had him at a conference, just learning about saying, hey, this is what's going on. I live in a community in Bristol where our police and the police chief are very focused on what's best for the people here and working together with the local health department. So I think that that's really important for people to see, because they may not understand it, right? They get a view of one versus the other. It's just a natural fit. I consider myself really fortunate to be invited to the screening at SCSU. And from the perspective of someone who has been in the field for 35 years plus, and I have familiarity with some of those urban environments, a few things jumped out at me, and I'd like to throw them out there and kind of get your takes on them, if you don't mind. The first is really from a sociological viewpoint. The film takes on a topic that is really difficult to discuss: the lack of awareness of much of the public of the struggles that Black, Brown, and other individuals of color experience deep in our cities. Addressing the white privilege that keeps so many from this perspective, was this something done consciously or simply a byproduct of the process?
No, it's something we did consciously, Jeff. And I actually think it goes a little bit deeper than Black and Brown and other minorities. It really becomes, if you really look at it, it becomes almost a class issue, because even you see, and while there are vastly more minorities in poverty in our cities, you do even see white people in poverty who are having the same issues. There is a little bit of it becomes a class issue, but I think a lot of it is about the minorities in the inner cities and the issues facing our inner cities. So, and that was really what we wanted to hit home in the documentary, that the inner cities of Connecticut are vastly different than the other parts of Connecticut. And the struggles are different than the other parts of Connecticut. And trying to start those conversations about these issues with people like yourself and other professionals in the fields of addiction and public health and law enforcement, so we can really start addressing these issues more holistically than we are currently.
Anything you want to add, Anna? Or you?
Obviously, as Bobby said, it was very deliberate. And again, going back to that balance between using personal stories and that subject matter expertise to really educate those people that may be unaware, that may not have the education, they may not have the understanding of addiction and also those root causes. I think a lot of the times when we, again, professionals in the field, we do so much education, we talk to so many people, but going back to the original thought of this being an educational tool, it's for that those people that may not have as much vast knowledge as we do around overdoses or addiction and some of those other issues. So really, that is why it was intentional.
And kind of going along with that, you know, something that hit me square in the face and was actually mentioned in the film were the social determinants of health and the effects of the SDOH at play. And just so our audience is fully informed, can you talk about social determinants of health in general and kind of some specific examples of things that affect our folks in these urban environments?
Again, during the planning phase, we had really important and insightful conversations with Charisse about addressing the impact of social determinants of health, especially as they relate to our inner cities. And it was clear to us that that topic deserved a lot of attention, especially when it's concerning addiction and overdoses in urban areas. We drew from our experiences here in Connecticut and, you know, sort of the observations Bobby and I and others have made firsthand around inner cities, and included, you know, widespread homelessness, the food insecurity, food desert issues, the limited access to quality healthcare, quality behavioral health services. Also, those alone have a lot of barriers, such as insurance, financial issues, language barriers. We hear a lot also the lack of cultural competency within the workforce of behavioral health and healthcare. So those are all issues we wanted to somehow bring up or address in some way in this documentary, because those are really important. And as far as social determinants of health go, those are the issues that really profoundly shape the experiences that people in inner cities really experience. And they grapple with that on a day-to-day basis. And so it's something that we really wanted to showcase.
I think without familiarity of those environments, you take certain things for granted, or you don't see transportation being one. Somebody may need to take 3 buses to get somewhere instead of jumping in a car to get there. And then even something as basic as childcare. For years, we used to say, oh, it was hard to engage women in treatment because they were non-compliant. Well, people have children that need to be cared for, and they're not just going to leave it with somebody, you know, that they don't know or whatever. So these are really important that I think the general public and parents and things understand as being difficult. It's been 50 plus years since Nixon launched the war on drugs, you know, which was generally enforcement focused, and it had a ridiculously unbalanced negative effect on Black and brown communities. Then came the opioid crisis, which at its onset was focused on prevention and care around pharmaceutical misuse in white communities. But we are now noticing the rising costs in the Black and brown communities of an incarceration at levels we've never previously seen. Can you envision the film as a call to action to increase attention and efforts in the cities to make things accessible for these communities?
The really meat of this question really plays into the social determinants of health. And I think it's, you know, and you could say there's, you know, of course, there's some systemic racism at play. There's some, you know, old school racism thoughts in the way we did things. But I think as a society, I think one of the great things about America and our society is we're always striving to get better, right? We may not always execute it correctly, but we're always striving. And I think one of the benefits we've seen is around the overdose and addiction crisis. There's been so many academic studies and research on these topics, and we understand so much more now than we did in the early 70s around these issues. I think seeing this kind of integration again of going back to one of the things you talked about in the beginning is the public health and public safety coming together and working together on these issues is really what's needed. And really, the idea of public health really advising law enforcement on what addiction is and what the cycles of addiction are and how they can more properly interact with people who have a substance use disorder and what is the right way to deal with a person with a substance use disorder who may have committed a low-level crime or not that serious of a crime or a non-violent crime. What are really the best ways to go about this? And I think you're right. The film does really, I think, bring a lot of these out. And I think the other thing we're starting to learn from the film. So Anna and I recently did a screening of the film with the State of Connecticut Department of Corrections for their addiction treatment offenders who are in the addiction treatment program. And one of the things that really stuck out to me was that is the discussion we had with the offenders afterwards who were able to see this, the documentary, and how many of them were up at Carl Robinson, which is all male, but how many of them really started in addiction because they were selling drugs, and they started selling drugs because they were living in poverty and they had no way to pay for food for their family. Like you said, they didn't have transportation to really get a decent job or get a job that didn't require them to take 3 buses and a cab. So, and all these things I think play a part, and they're all like dominoes in our inner cities, and they're all interconnected, and you pull one piece away or you knock one piece down and it all just comes crumbling down. And I think part of what we want from the film is like, there's a lot of issues in our inner city that need to be addressed. And young kids who are the only meals they're getting are at school. They don't have internet connections in their house. Like you said, they're walking really far to school or they're waiting by themselves for buses because they live in one parent households and the parent is trying to work at those hours. They're coming home by themselves. We have a lot of issues that lead to adverse childhood experiences, which then lead into addiction and other issues later in life. So we really, I think, look at this film as, like, just as you said, as a call to action, because these things need to start being addressed and we need to start creating more resilient children so that they don't get into addiction and substance use.
I think it addresses a couple of things. It certainly deals with the myth that individuals who are selling drugs in the community all love the hustle and the money. There are those that do, but it's almost out of necessity for so many. And it also identifies, if we can't identify the barriers that individuals have to getting what they need, there's no way we can address them. We can't sit on an ivory tower and say, this is what they need. We have to hear from the people living saying, what are the problems you're encountering? You know, how can we resolve those? And I think the film does a nice job of putting that out there, saying, these are some of the things that we deal with in reality. You're not saying bad versus good. It's just, this is what's happening. You're not putting a moral code on it.
Exactly. And I think your point about the hustle and bustle of people who sell drugs is important, because one of the things they did say to us is the first addiction they got was to the hustle and bustle. They started selling drugs to survive. They started selling drugs to provide for their family or put food on their own table or, you know, their family's table, or just meet bare necessities for them to survive. And they did become addicted to the hustle and bustle of that lifestyle. Then that translated into them starting to use their own product and becoming addicted that way. And I think that's a very... Even as somebody who was in law enforcement for 20 years, And I think a lot of these things, if you work in these spaces or adjacent to these spaces, you have these thoughts that way in the back of your brain. But until somebody really says it to you or punches you in the face with it, you're kind of like, you don't think about it in that or frame it that way in your thought process. And then you're like, oh, wow, that really makes a lot of sense. And that gives you a truer understanding of the dynamics of what is occurring in our cities than maybe we were previously thinking about it in a different way.
Things that may seem irrational to the outsider and say, why would they do that? Why would they do that? Are completely rational when you look at the thought process of getting their needs met. I need to do this, and then this follows, and this follows. Now, it may be antisocial, it may be whatever we want to call it, but it's certainly not irrational. It makes a lot of sense given the situation many people are in.
Correct.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the HIDA network so that the listeners understand the work of what you do, that it's not just criminal justice intervention. What are some of the different aspects of the work that the HIDA network does?
It's pretty interesting, Dev. So HIDA began in 1988. So it was federally funded through Congress, and it began with the anti-drug bill back in 1988. And really the focus of HIDA was to bring federal, state, and local law enforcement together to really enforce drug laws and disrupt drug trafficking organizations in our communities. And they really did that by funding task forces and bringing, you know, federal, state, and local law enforcement together to really work on this one issue of drug dealing in our communities. And really before this, the idea of task forces and law enforcement were almost solely for the purpose of serial killers. And after HIDA came in, there's the idea of working collaboratively across boundaries and became more commonplace. And there's been other task forces for other things, but this is where it really developed. And since 1988 until really 2015, this was really their main focus, is 100% enforcement of drugs. And then luckily, we had some pretty intelligent and progressive. Forward-thinking HIDA directors who were like, this isn't working. Us enforcing the drug laws is not working. And they came up with this idea of how do we bring law enforcement and public health together to work on this problem in our communities together? And that's really where the overdose response strategy started. It was this idea that we can make safer and healthier communities by working together rather than working separately. And I often say, I was a police officer in New Haven. We have Yale University. We have a lot of public health stuff in New Haven. We have hospitals. You can make an argument that harm reduction really began in New Haven for this country, or was at least one of the main drivers, Yale University, for harm reduction to go nationwide. And yet I had very little interaction with public health. Yeah, I would go to the hospital if somebody was injured. I would go to the hospital if there was some sort of event there. But outside of that, I never dealt with public health on any level. And it was really only those times I went to the hospital, I would deal with a nurse. You know, I would deal with the medics on a scene, but that was it. And then when this all started, having the ability to work with people in harm reduction and having the ability to work with people like Anna, who has a background in prevention, and other public health experts, and really just seeing how we're more alike than we are different. And if we work together, we can be so much more powerful and we can really address these issues in a more holistic, compassionate way for people who have a substance use disorder. And at the same time, make our cities and communities safer and healthier. And that's really, when you boil both public health and law enforcement down, they both want the same thing. They want safer, healthier communities. And so it kind of makes a lot of sense for them to work together.
I think that's an important point, because that's often missed when people just look at it through a single lens. And I know that ONDCP, you know, the Office of National Drug Control Policy in the 2010s, there was demand reduction, and that was my old friend David Mineta, and then there was supply reduction. But they didn't really work together as much. They both did their own thing. So I like the idea that it's about safer communities. Is that kind of how you see it? It's all about creating safer communities?
Yeah, absolutely. I think to Bobby's point, I know for myself, starting in this role, I worked with law enforcement on a youth prevention level, right? So thinking working on access and availability of substances, you know, doing some education, things like that. But coming into this role and being partnered with Bobby, being able to ask really, I guess, tough questions about the law enforcement field, but also, again, some of these things that public health may not think about. I think that what I've learned from him and is, well, law enforcement, they're obviously very reactive. They have to be, right? So me being in prevention, where we're trying to do the preventative stuff, right? Not to be reactive, but in prevention, we tend to somehow fall into the reaction part as well. But, you know, it just is a very different lens. Being a public health professional, really understanding the law enforcement view and lens helps me be a better public health professional. It helps me be more open to different ideas. And I think that that's really what this program and this collaboration really inspires us to do.
I think the amount of information and things that I have learned since coming kind of into the larger picture and not focusing as a treatment provider, but coming into the macro in, I think, 2009. So for the last 15 years, the picture that I've got of the system and systems is so different than what I had imagined, because I just didn't have familiarity. I had to go with whatever I heard from this person or that. So I think that talking about this collaboration and putting it forward and making it the norm, which it probably is in most communities, is really important to for people to understand in and out of the field. At the screening, I noticed there was a large amount of promotion for the ORS, that opioid response strategy. And for those that are unaware, as it sits right now, can you paint a picture of the ORS and what makes it unique? We know that they intersect with public safety, better communities, but what makes it unique and what does it look like right now, the opioid response strategy?
Yeah, so the overdose response strategy is a unique collaboration between law enforcement and really law enforcement through the HIDRA program and public health and really public health through the CDC. So it's this joint effort by the HIDRA program and the CDC to really do a lot of what we've been talking about here, get law enforcement and public health working together in our communities to address addiction and the overdose epidemic. And while there are some places trying to do that, and there are some isolated initiatives, this is a national program. We have teams in every state. Some of the larger states like Texas and California have three or four teams, but there's at least one team in every state. And it pairs a law enforcement person like myself with a public health person like Anna. And I think the benefit of this is, based on my credentials, I don't care if I picked up and drove to Montana, I could walk into a police department and they will let me in and listen to me, right? And so if you think about it, Anna, based on her credentials, can do the same in almost any public health environment. So we can both go into an environment and talk to law enforcement or talk to public health. But more importantly, we can translate and interpret for each other. So there is no miscommunication. That's so they both understand each other's languages and their meetings and a lot of times of what their lens is. What is the lens of law enforcement? What is the lens of public health? And how can we get those lenses more aligned, or at least understand the differences in the lenses enough so we can work together? And I really think that is where the uniqueness of the overdose response strategy is. For me and Anna, I think because we've created this really great environment here in Connecticut of being everywhere all the time, we kind of sit in between public health and law enforcement. And we're almost like a neutral arbitrator who's trusted by both sides, which really allows us to get and talk to public health and get their understandings of things, and then look at law enforcement, understand what they're seeing, understand the intelligence they're gathering. And then we can bring those things together and we can advise both sides in a more holistic and proper manner so they both understand what is going on. I think it's been pretty great here in Connecticut. And I think we're lucky, the Northeast in general, I think most of our law enforcement is educated. Most of our law enforcement receives what is considered some of the best training in the country. And most of our chiefs are progressive and they understand that not to use a cliche, but we're not going to arrest our way out of the problem. And if we're going to make our community safer and healthier, we need to understand that addiction is a disease, and we need to get people real help, not just help on paper, not just say, oh, well, we put them into the court system and the court system's going to get them help. We need to make sure they're getting connected to services and they're getting connected to the proper help they need or the assistance they need. Maybe it's not even help, like we were talking about before. Maybe they just need help with being unhoused and getting out of chaotic use and things like this, that which would make big differences in people's lives and our community's health and safety.
Yeah, even the smallest intervention of any kind may have tremendous effects depending on that person's needs and kind of where they're at in their life and their personal situation. Where can people find out more about the New England HIDA and the ORS? And how can the public or interested organizations access the film?
There is a New England HIDA webpage, newenglandhida.org. I believe it's NEHDA.org. There is a link to the overdose response strategy page there, but it also has its own webpage, which I believe is orsprogram.org.
Yes.
And so you can go to either one of those sites. And if you go to NEHIDA.org, there is a link on the New England HIDA webpage to request a screening. So there is a Silence on the Street section, and you can view both trailers. And also there's a tab to actually request to have the film screened in your community.
And I know there's some upcoming screenings. Meriden, Connecticut is one in the near future. Any others that are you to think of off the top of your head?
Yeah, there's so I think in the next month, we have the RX Summit in Atlanta we're doing April 2nd. The Meriden Public Library, I believe, is April 11th. And then we are doing the Guard Arts in New London on April 13th.
I love the RX conference. I usually go every year, but it's not in the budget this year. But I love going down to Atlanta and going to meet so many great people and hear what's going on around the country.
We were pretty honored that not only did they agree to screen it, because initially we were talking with them about screening it after hours, but they thought the film was so important that they decided to carve out a section during one of the days to show it during the day as a breakout session. So we're pretty excited about that.
And I think it'll resonate with people from around the country because the urban issues, although there are a lot that are geographically specific, you're going to see those all around the country.
I think you're correct, Jeff. I think if you're talking about the issues that people who live in an urban environment in this country, yeah, we are talking about Hartford and New Haven and New London. Those issues are going to resonate whether you're in LA or Chicago or Miami or Detroit. Those are kind of the issues that are the main issues that are causing a lot of the problems we have in our cities, especially when we're talking addiction and overdose.
Before we finish up, is there anything that we missed? Anything that either of you would like to add? Don't feel obligated.
I was trying to think. And I mean, I guess the only thing I would say is just speaking specifically for Connecticut, right? We've done a pretty good job the last 2 years. We're down, fatal overdoses are down 14%. There's still a lot of work to do. And I think the more we can get people to understand the importance of working together and the importance of addressing things holistically as a community, the better we're going to be. Because, I mean, we all know this. A lot of the issues that cause addiction and overdose also cause our crime rates. A lot of the root causes of our major societal issues have the place in dealing with this stuff in a preventative manner. And if we can understand that and work together to address those issues earlier rather than later, we could save ourselves a lot of heartache and a lot of loss of life.
The issues, they correlate with a lot of the, for lack of a better term, social problems that we deal with. So addressing these issues can have that domino effect impact. It can impact more than one aspect of things.
Oh, 100%.
Well, that's going to do it for this episode. I'd like to thank both of you, Bobby and Anna, for coming and taking the time. I know it's been long in the planning. I'm glad we got to do this. And to those of us that are listening, if you're interested in getting a screening or getting a group together, you can go to the NEHIDA website, and we'll talk to everyone later.